Hello and welcome back to the program. This is Beyond the Mekong, broadcast by The Diplomat, and we're in Mae Sot. And with me today is Paul Greening, who I interviewed earlier this year. Paul has been working with many an NGO civil society group since the coup in 2021 over the border in Myanmar. And Paul is going to give us a situation update. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Luke. It's very good to be back and talking to you again.
It is. The last conversation went very, very well, actually. And that was around May, I guess. But we've had the wet season. It's coming to a close. It has been wetter than usual, longer than usual. And the complaints about climate change have been long and loud. But the realities in Myanmar far from climate change, it's all about the civil war. How have things moved along during the wet season, and where do you see the situation going forward? Also, remembering that it was on November 11 last year that the anti-regime forces launched their dry season offensive, a bit later this year because of the rain. But how do you see things?
Well, firstly, Luke, I think this is a very opportune moment to talk again and summarise where we're up to. Because, of course, there was the elections on the 8th of November, 2020, where this all started.
Yep.
So it's quite an opportune moment to talk about it. At the moment, the revolution, it did continue through the wet season.
Mm-hmm.
The general sort of consensus and conceived notions are that conflict stops in the wet season. It did reduce a little bit, depending on the areas, but others, it didn't so much. Now, if we look at the situation at the moment, Myanmar's got 330 townships.
Mm-hmm.
Each one's got a town and villages, except around it. That's how this sort of the structure works. 86 of those, at least, have been taken already.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of towns, and that's out of 330 towns. But that is just the towns. The countryside, even more so. So the estimates are that over two-thirds of the country is controlled by the resistance.
That's a lot of area.
It is a lot of areas. And the resistance, of course, still lack weapons and bullets. And they're trying to raise money just to get bulletproof vests and helmets, just so they can actually survive attacks. But they've got enough to actually attack convoys and attack battalions, attack bases. And then they harvest the weapons.
Right.
So, and you see pictures all over the internet of them standing in front of a mass of bullets and different types of weapons, quite sophisticated weapons as well, which they've actually harvested. So they are getting better armed and better organised. They've actually coordinated a lot better. That's increasing all the time. Some internationals talk about fragmentation. I don't go with that. They're coordinating and working better together than ever before. More so in the ERO areas, less so in Sagang, Magway, the dry zone, that which I can come to later.
Yeah, they're both particularly interesting areas, particularly in terms of food, supplies, famine.
And the suffering as well.
Yep.
And of course, the military now, the Myanmar regime, is relying a lot more on airstrikes. That's increasing. Now, they're getting nervous about airstrikes because it's costing a lot of money.
Okay.
And there's a big pressure to get more and more sanctions on aviation fuel. The international community is not doing enough on that. Just stop all aviation fuel. Jet fuel for fighter craft is a little bit different to commercial, but one can get converted into the other. So stop the whole lot, because who's flying anyway, really? Mass killings, basic revenge killings, anything that actually is taken, any town that's taken, they bomb it to hell.
Yeah.
This is more spite and punishment than anything else. They're also burning villages. When they burn villages, before they did a lot of it using manpower, now it's more airstrikes because they haven't got so much manpower.
Right.
But they're still, when they get the opportunity, they are, or some of their militia, which are particularly nasty, are burning people alive.
I have heard this from several sources, and one of their favourite tricks, it goes back a long way. I was interviewing Stephen Am Sanford, who are journalists and have covered the war for a long time, and they were talking about how 2009, they were horrified to come across these people who had been tortured with an oily rag and a stick. You light the rag and you press it against the flesh. I am now hearing more and more of these stories. They're becoming more and more commonplace, and all you have to do is come here to Mae Sot and talk to a few rebels. And
recently, only less than a month ago, they had some beheadings and dismemberment in Sagang.
Now,
they probably killed them before, but this was just a tactic to terrorize people.
Yep.
And their tactic is pretty stupid. They think that by bombing them, displacing, and I think there's about 3 million displaced since the coup, besides all those that have been displaced from previous conflicts. They think that that is going to cower the Burmese population, and they're going to give up or put pressure on the EROs to give up. It's done the opposite. People get angry and they come back at them and they come back again.
And they're leaving. They're leaving the farms, they're leaving the fields, and they've got massive food shortages.
Oh, incredible.
They can't feed their own people now.
Yeah. And the airstrikes, apparently, just April 2022 to May 2023, there were 687 airstrikes.
Right.
There's been over 100,000 homes that have been deliberately destroyed by the junta. Most of that has happened, actually three-quarters has happened in Sagaing, and most of the rest in Magway. So they've suffered disproportionately far more than any others. And that is a Bama area, which was traditionally supporting the military more than others.
Sure.
So this is quite significant as well. Political prisoners, well, they now have about 6,000 political prisoners. You've got the military who are now, they just recently, Minh Lan came back from Yunnan, Kunming, meeting there. Wasn't actually a top level, but it was a provincial meeting, but he did meet the prime minister there. And he's looked at drone factories. Getting some drones from Russia, he's now wanting more from China because they're cheaper. He's copying basically what the resistance did. Mm. They started using farmers' drones, and most of them are still adapting farmers' drones or making them as little planes, as kamikaze. But now he's copying that, and he's getting sophisticated drones because they're cheaper and easier from China as well as Russia.
Well, when you're looking at drone attack from the rebels' perspective, in that they occupy, as you were saying, two-thirds of the territory, and they know where the military is, they know where their headquarters is. It's very easy from all that area to fly drones in onto a single target. That makes sense. But for a military which is essentially under siege, to mount a drone attack to where? Which of the 70-odd cities or the hundreds of odd bases do you want to attack, and what part in that base? It doesn't sound like a cohesive strategy.
No, basically when they do airstrikes after they've lost a town, or they're fighting the entail of a war and their people are running away or surrendering, etc., which a lot more are doing now, because a lot of conscripts come with a white flag in the back pocket because they don't want to fight anyway. There's no criticism of them at all.
No, I understand.
They were forced into it.
Yep.
And they're happy to leave. So they've got people on the front line that are basically not really interested, and they've just been used as human shields. No, they'll bomb. Instead of airstrikes going over and bombing, for example, I hear almost daily of planes going up to Mungdao. Now I'm hearing more and more from a friend in Chau Tor, because he sees them going over to Mungdao, a lot more drones going over.
Right.
To attack. So they're just cheaper. He's trying to save money. Because he's running out of money. They're running out of money.
Okay. And senseless attacks on civilian populations who are fleeing.
Exactly.
The mayhem they've started anyway.
They love hospitals, which is, of course, all international war crimes. So they seem to be looking for doing as much damage as committing as many and as greater international war crimes and atrocities as they possibly can.
Right.
One thing, if we look at something a bit more on the positive side, over 400,000 have joined the civil disobedience movement.
That's since the coup?
Yes. And also, a lot have left since conscription.
Mm-hmm.
They're dragging people off the streets. They're actually now wanting people to come back from Thailand.
Oh, good luck with that.
They're pushing the employment agencies that were sent over, not so much refugees from the conflict, but through employment agencies, they're saying they have to come back. So they're trying to get them back to conscript them.
So let me get this right. So if you're legal in Thailand and you came here through a legitimate employment agency, the military is leaning on those agencies to have those people return.
Exactly.
Oh dear, good luck.
And they're not having, of course they won't have their visas renewed and things like that. Mm-hmm. They'll do a lot of, hit them on the bureaucracy quite a lot. One thing that's interesting also happening, and it will increase, is in the urban guerrillas, the UGs. A lot more attacks through them. They've attacking airfields,
right,
as you said. And of course the military have jammers. That's what they get from China and Russia. They're sophisticated jammers to stop the drones. But still they flood them with a lot of drones. And you had one case which was, if you remember, in Nepador airport.
Yep.
Ala airport. Just 2 hours, they got it wrong by about 2 hours, but they hit that airport with drones 2 hours after Minh Aung had left to go to China.
Okay, so this was only a week ago, I guess.
Yes, yep, on the 5th of November.
They're pretty good with their timing. I remember when the NUG, well, they claimed they claimed it was one of theirs when they launched a drone attack on military headquarters as the United Nations was about to go into an open air session on Myanmar. I thought that was interesting timing and quite deliberate.
Yeah, they've hit an Air Force base north of Yangon, causing explosions. We don't know what damage because it's not going to be reported. Matilla, Mandalay, again, they've hit the Air Force base there. And there's been bombings around, targeted bombings in Yangon. So they're getting much more active. And also, if you look at the resistance tactics, they can't attack Mandalay directly. They can't attack big towns directly. But what they do is, even smaller towns, they surround it, they cut off their resources. They take the bases surrounding them on the hilltops. Mm-hmm. They take all of that. So then in the end, the people in the town, the soldiers, a lot of them are run away because they haven't got enough food, which they haven't anyway, you know, because they're under-resourced in that way, deliberately by the military. So then they run away and they take the town. And then you get the carpet bombing by the military. Mandalay will be the first of the biggest ones to go. I'm hoping they won't attack it too soon, but I think they'll cut off all the towns around it and they're getting very close to it.
Right. I was speaking to a group of rebels this morning. We had a breakfast session and one of the chaps was saying how you can be in Mandalay and you can talk to military soldiers and then you can drive for less than an hour, 45 minutes, and you can talk to the rebels. And he actually said, quote unquote, the rebels were very nice, very friendly. Yeah, so I thought that was interesting, but that gives people an idea about how close they are to Mandalay. And if I remember correctly, they've got the north, south, west, south, east flanks pretty much covered.
Exactly. One thing you mentioned earlier, just a bit earlier, was Segang and the dry, what the people call the dry zone, which is a bit around Mandalay, so it's connected to that. And so, of course, Segang and Magway.
Yep.
Now, there's been a lot of publicity about that, and in the sort of what I read, of people saying, well, all these groups, these PDFs, People's Defence Forces under NUG, they're fighting each other, some are gangsters and things like that. Mm-hmm. Well, you've got hundreds of them.
Right.
And it's less than 0.5% that is doing that. But still, that is a problem. A far bigger problem, because that can be controlled, that's criminality, which you have in every military and every sort of revolution. That needs to be controlled. But they need to coordinate better.
There are perception issues which aren't all positive.
Yeah.
I was chatting with another rebel who was a former colonel in the military, and she kind of said everything wrong. We were talking about the Rohingya in Arakan, and she said that some of the Rohingya have been fighting with the military. And I'm like, yes, but the military is made up of people from Myanmar. Everyone in the military is from Myanmar and they represent all ethnic groups. Just to single out the Rohingya, these sort of very annoying, aggravating signs of racism that they still get. But, you know, Rakhine has been diabolical over the last few months. But, sorry, as you were saying, going back to Segang.
No, I can comment quite a lot on that.
Right.
But with the dry zone, I think something that will help, you've got the Bama National Revolutionary Army, which is under Bo Naga. He's already fighting in that area. In fact, recently he took Palais Town, but of course had to pull out because of heavy airstrikes.
Right.
So he's already going there. One thing that's very significant, I'm very pleased about, is the Bama People's Liberation Army.
Okay.
They're mostly Bama, but yeah, they take ethnic.
Is that an ethnic armed organisation or a PDF?
It's a ethnic. It's an army, ethnic armed organisation. Okay. They've worked a lot with the AA. They fought together with the AA and MNDNA. The Kokang on the border, including the Tahang, TNLA, the Tahang National Liberation.
That'd be very successful.
Yeah. So they have experience now. They've got about 1,200 troops. They're recruiting a lot more. The leader is this famous poet, Mung Sanka, who was forced into it because he saw no other option except to fight. And he's very charismatic.
Right.
He's very charming. I've seen pictures of him and seen reports. And your old grizzly generals, he's having them laughing and joking with him. He's very, very good at that. So if anyone can help bring the PDFs in Segang and Magway together,
he might be the person.
He's not going to work under NUG. He's going to cooperate with them, but he's not going to be part of NUG.
Okay.
But that is quite a positive. And I think it's a hell of a task for him, but I think if anyone can do it, he can probably do it. And he gets on K with Bo Naga, who's great, but probably not so much of a diplomat.
And of course, what we're also talking about, going back to when we last chatted, is that The last dry season offensive, the ethnic armed organisations and the PDFs were quite successful in retaking their ethnic territories.
Mm.
The big issue is, will they go forward into Barmer State? Now, they're split over that, but what it requires is troops from the different EAOs to essentially volunteer. And I understand that the TNLA were one of the first, and they need to form kind of joint militias with each other in order to head towards Naypyidaw, but Mandalay first.
Surrounding Naypyidaw and hitting it occasionally.
Right, making life miserable.
Exactly. You've also got, people don't think, for example, the Karen, you think they're just working in their own area. They're fighting in Bagu. Mm-hmm. They're fighting far, far, far out of their own area.
Yep.
And they have been for quite a while. So this idea, I think at the beginning, the EROs had a flood of young activists or disgruntled or angry people who'd been shot at in the streets, said, train us. They got involved. At first, maybe their objective was to increase their territory, increase their, you know, their strength and consolidate that. It's gone well beyond that.
No, they don't need the numbers like they used to. That's what's quite interesting in that here in Maysot, you know, I'm meeting 25-year-olds who have a couple of years experience on front lines. They're war veterans at 25 and they're not needed. A lot of them have gone, some of them have gone a little loopy in their head, others are nursing wounds, some are just tired. But the old idea that the opposition within their ranks, or sorry, when I say opposition, I mean the rebels within their ranks, they can afford to let troops take a break and head over to Maysot, or across the borders all the way along with Thailand. Meanwhile, the military is practicing, you know, enforced conscription, the harshest type, and no one wants to know them. It doesn't stack up for them.
No, in fact, the conscription has been very sort of counterproductive, because what they end up with is some troops that they use as human shields mostly, who have no desire to fight, have no experience of fighting.
No, they can't do it.
They've never been under fire. They've been told how to pull a trigger, and that's about it.
Yep.
So the first thing they do, as I said, is they get the white flag out of the back of their pocket and say, and they're welcomed over, and they're treated well, of course.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them have actually escaped. Some have come, of course, to Maysot and, you know, to other areas on the border. With passports, they've managed to get to Bangkok, and most of it's to Thailand, to be honest. It's easier. Some over to...
I've heard the complaints, but I think Thailand and a lot of the Burmese I've spoken to are quite thankful for Thailand. I think they've done a pretty good job, given the sheer numbers that are coming over. It's a damn sight higher than the hundreds of thousands people talk about. I think some people would say it's closer to 2 million across Thailand. It's quite something, but the Thais have done a very good job in terms of looking after, particularly Thais at the local level.
No, I agree. There's maybe a bit of a difference between the local level and the Bangkok level.
Mm.
Recently, the Prime Minister, in the meeting in Kunming, Minong Lang, she referred to him and his government. Mm. She referred to his government, which upset people. She said it was an internal affair in Myanmar, etc. So she doesn't really know too much about it. Her father's probably a bit out of date.
Yep.
Thaksin Sinawat. So their attitude, just like China and India, is you leave it to the Myanmar military, it'll get sorted out, and then we can carry on doing business.
Yep.
Their main objective is the business. They don't really want to step on the toes, certainly not officially, of Myanmar. How that will change, I don't know. You've got some very, very good politicians.
Mm-hmm.
I always get his name wrong. Kanawi, I think it is. The Fair Party. He's only MP.
Yep.
He actually said, because the Prime Minister said she will support the elections.
Which is, we'll get there in a minute.
In Myanmar, are a complete and utter joke.
Yeah, no, it's... let's go there now. As you were saying before, the anti-regime forces, that's 20 EAOs, some people say EROs, but for the audience's sake, it's the same thing, ethnic armed organisations, a lot of PDFs control about two-thirds of the country. The military, according to my last figure, was that they control 14% of the country, which actually means that the remaining fifth, something like that, is in dispute. Now, how on God's earth can you back an election, a military that threw a government out of power, which was elected, has committed carnage, which is on the same scale as Gaza, if people really wanted to go there, and support an election in 2025 run by a military who, well, logistically it's impossible, and B, that they don't control anywhere near the kind of territory that one would expect in terms of recognition internationally, but yet the international community at a government level insists on maintaining this kind of, you know, well, we'll negotiate with the military. So what are you talking about?
But you look at the countries involved in Southeast Asia or Asia generally, and how many of them are democratic?
Yeah, sure.
And what they're going to say is, this is not perfect, there was many problems with it, but it's certainly a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
And America's going to say, and the West, as they usually say,
well, America's a little
different, leave it to ASEAN.
I don't think that's going to happen now with Donald Trump. In fact, the best, you know, quite possibly that if China has influence in here, maybe Donald Trump will show some interest. But he's not expected to negotiate through ASEAN. And I think we're in for a totally different ball game coming up. But by what you were saying, I mean, we have the former Australian Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, who is the UN Special Envoy for Myanmar, didn't say a word for months and then finally uttered a few sentences, which were kind of, a dreadfully written ASEAN press release. And then I made a point of asking this group of soldiers for the EAOs and PDFs, I asked them, what do you know about Julie Bishop? Do you know who she is? And they're like, huh? These people, they have fought on the front lines. They are fighting for the survival of their country. And they have no idea who the special envoy is for the United Nations.
This is no surprise, because they've lost interest, those that had interest, in the UN a long time ago. They consider them out of the picture, useless, or actually counterproductive in helping the revolution. You know, there's a whole line of them queuing up to shake hands with junta officials.
Yep.
You know, to be clear, I've met some really good, and in contact with some really good heads of international NGOs and UN people. At quite senior level. Some are really excellent and they're doing lots of stuff, often covertly, but they're doing lots of stuff. But generally, the whole institution seems to be more interested in perpetuating itself, securing its position in Yangon, getting its visas, having its offices, having its cars, even if it can't do much in country. And they're not really analysing, or they don't really care about, could they do more outside the country? Would they be more cost effective, etc., etc.? Even one thing interesting in Sitwe, I checked on it. I was worried that they will leave their national staff there.
This is the United Nations.
Yeah. And INGOs. So I've talked to both. I've talked to quite, I can't say who, but I talked to some very high level people. And they assure me that they have actually got plans to actually evacuate them. I was afraid that the airport would be closed off and the junta would use UN national staff as human shields.
Right.
Because they're bringing a lot of people in from the villages anyway as human shields, Rohingya especially. But apparently that's not going to happen. They have actually thought of their staff, and they're getting some of their staff out already, and they say essential staff. But one thing, a bigger picture, do we need the UN in there?
Yeah.
Because they're not cost effective.
What are they doing?
Well, it's not so much what they're doing. If they're doing it, they're doing it through different organisations. Can't they do that outside the country?
Okay.
That's one thing. Maybe you need, well, WFP can't really act. They wait months to actually get access. But wouldn't it be more cost effective to go straight to CSOs or maybe an INGO that works with the CSOs, the civil society organisations, to get aid across to the people that they know the needs, they know how to do it. They've been doing it for decades, especially with the Karen. Why not actually have that? The UN will take 40% of every grant off.
Right.
That will go for overheads. And then there's a 7% for headquarters. This is not cost effective. CSOs will take almost nothing. They put their hand in their own pockets. An INGO with skeleton staff that just does the administration, some program support and capacity building, quite cheap. You'd save a fortune. Now funding is going to go down. With America, most people who know and have analysed what's going to happen after Trump say that the funding is going to be reduced. You might even have, you could have USAID scrapped even. You've got the Burma Act, which is fine, that'll go ahead. But how about the funding for the Burma Act? This is a problem. This is a big, big problem with Trump coming in. Another thing, of course, with Trump, which is, and this is ironic as hell. You had a lot of people, Burmese, living, maybe quite a long time, most of them doing manual work. A lot of Karen, for example, churches, who have had a lot of influence there. They voted for Trump because they thought it was good for the economy. They didn't realise what's going to happen. First of all, resettlement. You've got 91,000 people in the nine camps along the border, mostly Karen. 60,000 of those have already said they want to go to America and registered.
Yeah, I've heard they've already given up.
They can forget it.
Yeah,
they can forget that. Those, how about all those that have been processed And actually, you know, UNHCR said they are genuine refugees and they've got permission, especially America, Australia, but mostly America, to go there. And they're waiting. Some have even moved down to Bangkok to be closer to the airport. One said, I know it's ridiculous, but it means my wife is not going completely crazy. She's taking drugs for depression already. So what's going to happen to all these people? And we've got a lot of them. They've been waiting for 3 years in a hoop. And also, he's likely to throw people out of the country.
Said he will.
Yeah, and how many Burmese he's going to throw out? Easy to violate a visa. You go a couple of days over your visa, things like that, you forget to...
I think this is another podcast for later on, because I think we need to wait and see what happens after he's sworn in. It's easy to imagine the worst, because with Donald Trump, he's often delivered on that. But
the best we can hope for is benevolent neglect to Burma.
Which may well happen.
Getting
back to Mandalay.
Yeah.
What are the chances of Mandalay falling to the rebels? They were talking about by the end of this year. That may not be possible, but what's your forecast for the seat of kings, as it is known?
I know. Well, it's the third biggest country, biggest city in the country, very significant culturally, as you said. I don't think this year.
Right.
I don't think any chance this year. I think, and I hope, there'll be some restraint, because it's going to be a bloodbath. I hope they'll cut it off. They'll cut it off and strangle it.
Basically, a siege mentality.
Yeah, they'll strangle it. And Nepador as well. Yeah, they've got one road.
Nepador would be easy.
Because it's got one road.
Yeah.
For security, they've got one road, which looks like a runway. Because
it is a runway.
Exactly, that's what I was going to say. So they've got that.
Yeah.
So it's quite easy to cut it off. Ironically, because it was made like that for security.
Yeah.
But it worked the other way as well. So I think they're going to do the siege mentality. They're going to do that. It's going to be cut off. It's going to increase. One thing I think is very significant, and it could happen this year, is in Arakan.
Yep.
I think AA controls about 80% of Arakan already. There's 17 townships. They control about 11. An, which is the Western Command, very significant. They surrounded it. They just took 300 troops that gave up and surrendered to them the other day.
Right.
So that's done. One thing that's interesting with An as well, you've got Chopyo, which of course Chinese interests, that with the gas and the gas pipeline.
Well, that's where we go next, because...
I know. But An, where does the pipeline go? It goes through An. So if they control An, they take the Western Command, they also can control the gas.
This is true.
Without taking Chopyo.
Sure, but this is where international diplomacy is going to have to come into play, because... So Arakan, also known as Rakhine State, it's where the Rohingya are, it's where the Chinese oil and gas pipeline runs all the way through and up into Yunnan. The Chinese need predictability and they need to know their asset is secure. They don't need the Arakan army delivering ultimatums, but if the Arakan army and the others who are along that whole pipeline area, which I'll quickly add that I think the Chinese have earmarked $50 billion to be spent along that corridor over the next 30 years.
Well, they want a railway line. Go all the way from Kunming straight through to Chopyo, and then it can go over to India and the rest of the world.
So, I mean, it's been a hell of a bloodbath over there, and I would argue that the Arakan army needs to take control, but settle down and start negotiating.
That's very interesting, because China... As opposed to, say, Russia or maybe even India. India's now coming around a bit. But they were playing both sides.
Yep.
They want stability. They don't care who wins.
That's right.
That's what I was thinking. That they want stability. They're just... Everything they talk about is their economic interests. The Belt and Road, etc. Now they seem to be putting all their eggs in one basket, and they seem to be supporting the military much more than before.
They are. That's been said by others.
And one thing that they're doing now, which is very worrying and could actually bring America more in, to some extent anyway, is they've suggested a joint security force. That means Chinese military, together with Burmese military, the regime, in Myanmar, protecting Chinese assets, because they don't believe that the Burmese military can check. So that means you could actually have the resistance directly fighting Chinese soldiers.
I don't think the Chinese really want to put boots on ground in terms of the middle of a civil war. However, they have tried this stunt in other countries around the region. Example, Cambodia said, no, you're compromising our sovereign interests. Okay, fine. But the human trafficking and scam compounds have blown out of all control. And the only people who are capable of ending that bloody scourge is probably the Chinese. And I suspect that the real reason why they want to put a joint security force in there is more about the human trafficking and the scan compounds, which is giving Beijing a dirty reputation.
I don't fully agree, especially with the other side of the country, the West, with Rakhine.
Yep.
They're talking about protecting their assets there.
Okay.
And they're protecting the gas pipeline, etc. And they suggested it, apparently, to Minerline, a joint military force. Like, we have to see what comes out of that. But if that happens, that is frightening.
Well, now, a bit like the Americans in Vietnam, really.
Exactly. It's been compared to that. Another thing, we know Russian technicians have come in. We know there's quite a few Russian technicians.
Well, they've got a lot of Russian technology.
Exactly. So we got quite a few. But are these really technicians? Mm. There's rumours that some might be remnants the Wagner Group, which is dispersed all over Russia.
Sure. I mean, the Russians can't really afford to spare too many soldiers anyway.
No, but the Wagner,
taking North Koreans.
The ex-Wagner Group?
Yeah.
And they're dispersed all over, so there's less control. There's not one central control. There's talk of them as mercenaries coming over. I've got no proof of that, but I'm hearing rumours of this.
Well, it'd be no surprise.
It wouldn't be a surprise, but that will complicate things again.
Right.
And that might be influential to American interests, and it might spark something with Trump.
We're actually running out of time, so that's okay. What's your prognosis for the next 12 months, or particularly between, say, we're in November, so December through till mid-next year, until the next rainy season begins? What do you think will happen?
Well, I think it will probably go through the next rainy season, but in some areas it will reduce just like it has before. Mm-hmm. I think the whole of ARICOM would be taken by the AA.
Mm-hmm.
India is arranging a meeting with AA, but also India had a meeting with seven loyal to the junta EROs, which are small, ineffective, but with the junta, New Delhi. I think it's in December, they want to meet NUG and the EROs there.
Mm-hmm.
So India's getting more involved now, because they want the Kaladan highway, and that means AA.
As soon as
AA took Palawa and Chin, they started talking to them.
Right, okay.
So India's going to get more involved in that way. Not for peace, but for their own economic interests. But I think all the Arakans can be taken, it can be the first state in the country to be taken by a resistance organisation. The others are going to coordinate more and more. AA, the KIA has taken rare earth mines in the north. That China relies on that. China's cut off trading gate. And KIA said, yes, okay. And they closed them down as well.
Well, and that's contributing to the food shortages. And
exactly.
The trade.
We've got that. And we've got the Bama Resistance Army and also the Bama National Army going over to try and work together with the PDFs and NUG in Sagang and Magway. So that's going to be unifying them as well. So I think there'll be a lot more coordination. NUG's actually asked for more coordination. They're organising meetings with them all to coordinate. So there'll be a lot more coordination in that way. I think important to mention on the humanitarian front is going to be a disaster. In Rakhine, they're saying 2 million people are starving. I'm talking to people on a daily basis. A Rohingya friend of mine climbs a hill after 11 o'clock at night when he can get a bit of internet, 40 minutes up the hill, and he'll start messaging me. They have got starvation already. I'm getting pictures of babies that are tested and it's red. Mm-hmm. It's in the acute malnutrition stage. And one person works for an INGO, a medical one, said it's at higher rates than ever he's seen except in Africa at one time.
Right.
In a famine. So we've got that. There's going to be mass starvation. Now, what needs to be done and is really frustrating is a lot of the donors and the UN and even INGOs are still following their processes.
Right.
And they say, yes, I'll talk to so-and-so in 2 months' time or 2 weeks' time. And it'll take another month to sign the contract. I said, how many people are going to bloody die before that happens? But they need to adapt more. They need to do more cross-border aid. They need to work with the EROs a lot more. Cut down the procedures. Be flexible. Be imaginative. Because people are dying waiting for their procedures to come in.
Okay, so I think what we're looking at is that the anti-regime forces are going to consolidate, lay siege to Mandalay, take control of Rakhine and the oil and gas pipeline. Meanwhile, there's going to be a lot of starvation with people continuing to flee the country, and NGOs are going to be kind of quartered, not quite knowing where to go or how to do it, while the politicians and leaders of regional countries are talking up elections for a military that controls about 14% of the country.
Play a nice summary there, Luke. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I should have said that.
That's what they pay me to do. Okay. Thank you very much. It's been a great chat.
It was very nice. Thank you, Luke.
We'll do it again.
I hope so.
Cheers, mate.
Lot to talk about.